Now on Documentary on News Talk, an unconventional writer's workshop challenges attitudes to education and creativity and forges new relationships when Kevin McDermott meets Calvin Folan and Abby Campbell in Write It Down, Write It All Down.
Abby, you're going to say hello. Do you know what you're reading today? What are you reading?
Part of the
novel, yeah. Is this your dad, is it?
Yeah.
That's Daniel. We met, yeah. And did you know you're going to get an award later?
No.
Well, I don't want you to be surprised because I don't want people to faint or anything. So at the end, you are going to get an award. So that's kind of part of the reason why you wanted your dad to be here to see that. Calvin, tell me what you're going to be reading.
It's a poem called Hollywood.
Tell me a bit more about it.
It's got to do with the fear of the expression of oneself and how they will be treated by the world for expressing themselves. And that's my main theme, got to do with it. That's what it's based around.
You're nervous?
Not particularly, no.
And you know you're getting an award, don't you?
Yes, indeed.
Are you pleased
with
that?
Yeah, that's why I'm out here, you know?
Okay, well, we'll talk to you a bit later and we'll be recording what you're saying, all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good night. Good morning, folks. How are you? You're all very welcome to the Oak Room in the Mansion House. And I'm Kevin McDermott, and I'm the writer in residence with the CDE2B Schools. And this morning, we have a showcase of the writing of the young writers with whom I've been working for the last year, and in some cases for the last 2 years. We have the launch of the novel Mary's Shadow, which was written with the help of some of the young writers. And then we have the presentation of awards to some of our terrific emerging writers. I was working in the 12 post-primary schools in the city of Dublin. And they're all in the old working class areas of Dublin. So you have Whitehall, you have Cabra, you have Finglas, you have Coolock and Crumlin and Ringsend and so on. It's always a bit nerve-wracking going into a school. I'm not a young man, I'm in my 60s, I'm a man. I went into one school and one of the kids looked at me and said, under her breath but loud enough, you know, for me to hear, "Oh, look, here comes Granda." So, you know, you don't know how the kids are going to react to you. Some of the young writers who go in are, you know, a lot, have more street cred than I have, say. Anyway, so you go along and you meet, and I met the young writers, and Calvin was in the group in Cloisch de Dulick. And the way it worked in the schools was that all of those schools are in areas of designated disadvantage, according to the Department of Education. And as part of the supports put into the schools to help students have the fullest possible educational experience, they fund a library and a paid librarian. And that's through a scheme called the JCSP. And that's to support students who might otherwise be at risk at leaving school. But what happens really in those schools is that the library becomes a really important centre for culture, for the arts, for enrichment experiences for kids. And in the first year of the residency, I'd been asked would I try to write a novel that reflected the experiences of the young writers. So it wasn't that we were only writing the novel, we were writing about their experiences, but the stories we talked about and the conversations we had fed into the novel. And so what happened then in those conversations is that the young writers, in a way, they talk their life into existence as a text, a talking text, if you like. And then I'd encourage them to write that down in their notebooks. and I would take some of the things they told me and I'd incorporate it into my story. So that's basically how I met Calvin. That's how we started to work.
I describe myself as creative-minded, headstrong, and ambitious. Not necessarily the most academically gifted individual. Like, I wouldn't necessarily get all A's in the Leaving Cert. That just isn't going to happen for me. But I would describe myself as very ambitious. And I try desperately to just keep moving forward in my life, in my personal life, within my relationships with people, and also within my potential career. Well, to be honest, I'm not going to go into detail, but I think I was brought up, I had a childhood where I had to really grow up fast, to be honest. Like there was family troubles and whatever the case may be, and I just said to myself, Cal, either you're going to get sucked into this, or you're going to get sucked into that, you're going to feel sorry for yourself, or you're just going to push forward and push on with it. And it's through that, and through being able to push through that I have... gained this sort of wisdom that other people say I have. Now, I don't think I'm a very wise person, but I've had other people say that to me. Yeah, it would have been very much an epiphany. That's the best way to describe it. I think it was about eight. I was about 18 at the time, and I was going through a severe bout of depression at the time, and I'm talking absolutely severe, where I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning, and then I just woke up one morning and I was just like, Cal. I looked around me and I was just like, Cal. What are you doing with yourself? You need to get up. You need to get out of this mindset. You need to actually stop focusing on your own emotions and just like throw yourself into something. Throw yourself into the world and let the world know who you are and what you stand for. And that is when I finally decided to make a change and become not only a more confident, but a much more, I'm not going to say confident, social and eccentric individual. I was very beaten down. I couldn't really see far in front of me. And that was, to be honest with you, like I didn't know how I was going to feel from one day to the next. Or I knew there was this one consistent motion of one consistent pattern of like just having like a dark cloud of negative emotions like drawn over me constantly. Like, where I had no motivation to do anything. I had no motivation to go outside. I had no motivation to study for anything. I had no motivation. I had no goals to do anything except just wallow in my own emotions and my own negativity.
Same process meeting Abby. Abby was in Margaret Aylward School. Any youngster who was interested in meeting a writer and possibly working with me was invited along. Initially, we probably had more kids who came to get off class than we had kids who really wanted to write. But then there was a little core group, a friendship group, and Abby was a part of that. And that conversation, I really remember it vividly the first time I went in and we had a real conversation. I was asking them about this idea of safety and where they felt safe in their world. And Chantelle and Abby began to talk about that. And the two of them told a really fantastic story that I knew that these are two great young writers and that they could talk about their world in ways that were really exciting and brought their world to life. And so my job then as a writer was just to almost reflect that back to them and say, look how brilliant you guys are at talking about your life. And I'm going to try to capture that vividness when I'm writing about Mary. And Mary's voice will be partly your voice because you've really helped me to realise what the way she might be and the kind of girl she might be. Writing isn't about the stuff you just write down on the paper. Writing is about the stuff you talk into existence. So I kind of envisaged it almost like a theatre ensemble. And we came together and we almost workshop ideas about the characters I was trying to work on. And the young writers contributed and tried out voices. And so when they had tried stuff out, when they'd spoken it, as far as I was concerned, the text was composed. And for me, the kind of writing we were doing, the kind of text we were composing, absolutely related to their real lives. And they were you know, to say the obvious, but they're expert on their lives, on their world. And it became apparent really quickly that Abby had a really good ear for dialogue. And little things that I'd write, and when she wrote her versions, were probably better than my versions. And that's always good for a young writer, to feel that you've outwritten the published writer. And always a bit sobering for the published writer to realise you've been outwritten by a novice.
Name's Abby Campbell. Being in an all-girls school, like, you kind of don't really have to have that attitude, you don't care what other people think. Someone's giving it, you have to be able to take it, but you also have to be able to give it back. And you have to know the difference between messing and not messing, because, like, some people could say something and you'll take it offensive, but I was only messing. But, like, you're after going and having a fight with them, and after I was only messing doesn't really cut it anymore. And then, like, when you're outside of school, like, and you're walking with all your friends, and then you'd have, like, a group of young fellas, like, screaming stuff at you, and you're just, like, there's nothing better to be doing than standing outside centre screaming stuff at us. And you just walk on and keep ignoring them. Sometimes, like, if someone start slagging me or throwing abuse, like, I'd be able to just give it back. But then there'll be other days where it, as much as I'm trying to give it back, it's just hurting me, and then I just lose it. It's like there's only so much you can take, and then you just completely lose it. Like, I would never be like one, like a fight or anything, but like I could have to learn to, in case like if someone put their hands on me, like I'd have to learn to like hit them back, because I used to like, if they hit me I'd just run away crying, but now I'm like, here, no. Like, if someone hits you back, like, I hit them, and it's like, I look all sweet and innocent, but, like, I'm just like, no, don't.
And in the book, Mary, at one stage, looks at her ma and sees almost the young woman her ma still is, and realises that she's grown up and she can see her ma in that way. Now, a lot of the young writers could see their ma's as resilient, as brave, as shown fortitude in the face of adversity, never given up on them, being dependable, even when they drove each other mad. But, you know, the ma's always came true. But that also then led to some of the kids saying, I'm the strong person in my family. And what holds my world up, or who holds my world up, is me. And also, I was really pleased to be able to give them a forum in which they could try that idea out and give it voice and say, no, yeah, I think that's true. And I think that was really interesting about the workshops. The workshops gave the young writers a space where they could try ideas out, where they could present themselves and represent themselves in a certain way with someone who was really supportive of them and wanted to hear that voice and didn't judge them. And it was okay sometimes if you said something and went, oh, maybe that's not true. But I remember Calvin talking about his inner strength. I remember Calvin talking in a really vivid, clear way about, you know, the way he kind of felt he had to physically hold himself up and morally hold himself up, and saying that at one stage he felt that he had remade himself and had determined that his life was going to be really positive. And that was, for me, not only, well, I find him a really endearing young man, but I was really, really taken by how he spoke and admiring of how he spoke. And I think sometimes you found with Abby and with our pal Chantel and some of the girls and Margaret Aylward, they'd also talk about having an inner strength. And Chantel sometimes talking about, you know, safety and saying, well, if there were lads said that to me, you know, I wouldn't be afraid to stand up to them. And there was a bit of bravado in that, but there was also a sense in saying, I don't want to go through the world being afraid. And I think Abby looking at herself and saying, you know, I think I have moral courage to live my life. And I think you need to be strong in your world. So the notion of the kids getting absorbed and get into the flow of language through telling stories about things that really matter to them, or things that were really made them alive in their bodies, it also made them alive in their language. And for a writer, that's exactly what you want. That's, you want language to be alive. And how do you get language alive? You talk about things that the kids feel alive.
I'd say I was intrigued by it more so than anything. And then I met Kevin and the rest of the lads, and we all got together. And he allowed me to express my own emotions and how I felt about a certain topic. And he allowed me to just express myself and like how I see the world, you know what I mean? There was no limitations, like saying you should write about this or you should write about that. There's certain times he came in and said, like, write on this certain theme, but in most cases it wasn't like that at all. And I think I've had that experience and that whole like free thought experience literally only a handful of times, like within the education system. Then I met Kevin, as I mentioned, and he was very, very impressed by my work as well. So I'm very much thankful that I was able to get even these handful of opportunities to be able to think freely and write freely about myself and who I am as a person. But the education system is very much built to a certain standard. It's not adaptive. Like, it's not like in Scandinavian countries like Finland and whatever, like where they don't have exams. They don't have exams in Finland. Like, they only have like one when they're like 16, and it's not even a big deal, you know. And the fact that this education system is built towards every exam is just, it's very flawed to me. It's something I just can't comprehend, because it's just, why? I mean, like, and the teachers and everything say, like, and this is not a reflection on them, but they say, like, oh yeah, school is where you can be yourself and be amongst friends and whatever. But no, it's not like that at all. You're being asked to just memorize facts and memorize dates and whatever. It's not about being yourself at all. It's not about expression at all. And then, like, we have certain skills that limit others for wearing like makeup and earrings. And I'm just like, you want to promote expression of oneself, but yet you want to limit that? That's hypocritical at best.
There's so many people in the room. Most of them just wanted to get out of class. But then as it went along, it got smaller, and then it was the main people, and then we kind of came out of our little comfort zone, start writing. Because when it's packed, people are just messing and all, then like you have to keep giving out to them, and then we're not getting as much done as we usually can. But when it's smaller, like, you get more done than when there's loads. I've always just kind of wrote. So then when I thought like of a writer's club, I was like, this might help me stories and poems get better. So I just went with it, then I really enjoyed it. The difference between like when Kevin and like the teachers correct it, like teacher mark, like if I spelled something wrong, but if I spelled it wrong, it'd more than likely be I'd want it to be spelled wrong, because I'm trying to, it'd be like the way they're pronouncing it, so it'd need to be spelled wrong. But then like if I gave it to the teacher, it'd just come back with like circles and X's and question mark, and you need to put a dot here and this. And Kevin had just like, if I wrote a poem, sometimes I'd have to give him a blank page, because if he wrote over it, I'd just like have anxiety, like, no, he can't, here's a blank page, write it beside it and I'll work on it. Because of like Kevin helping, like now I can look at my work and see, like, I can give my own feedback now, and said like, because I can't rely on my friends, because they'll just say that's good. Like I can read in front of, like, I used to be afraid to read out loud because like sometimes I'd stutter. But like now, like if I start, I just go again, or I just laugh. But like if I'm reading, sometimes I like, get really, really into the character, and like my hands would be going everywhere and all. But now I don't really mind. Like people, like when I'm reading, people laugh. They're laughing with me, not at me. Now I just kind of look at it that way. Some probably are laughing at me, but I don't care.
Well, we're on Clough Road. We're just at the junction of Sundrive Road and Clough Road, just outside St Bernadette's Church. And so the house over there, 41 Clough Road, that's where I grew up. So behind these houses there's a field, And that's where we spent nearly all summer playing. I'm going to walk into the field down here. What's interesting about my sisters, when they were in school, and this is where you talk about motivation, they always had the view that no one expected anything of them because they came from the corporation estate. That, you know, they were kind of expected that they would simply go into sewing or go and work in Lamb's jam factory. And there was no expectation that kids from Crumlin or from Dolphin's Barn would somehow become anything. And so part of the motivation wasn't so much about me. It was almost that I kind of felt a resentment that my lovely siblings, my older siblings, whom I really admire and love, that there were people actually looked at them and dismissed them. Not because of anything in themselves, but because of where they came from. In school, I heard those stories. And as I became an adult, became more aware of them. I think that became kind of part of my motivation in terms of trying to be a teacher or trying to work with kids and writing, was the idea that you never look at a child and say, because you come from a particular place, because you grow up in, you know, part X part of the city, that somehow your life expectation should be less. But sometimes in schools, we're so busy teaching curricula, we're so busy covering courses, we don't get a chance to talk to kids about, well, what are the things that are really happening in your life that are important? Like, what's happening? How are things at home? What's happening? And it's not that you're a counsellor, you're just talking about their life. And you're giving them a chance to talk in their way about their life, to think about it, and to write from it. And the writing that comes from it, when it's engaged, is seriously good writing. Schools are kind of interesting places. There's a disciplinary regime, and the disciplinary regime, both in terms of, you know, you have to behave in a certain way, and there's the regime of subjects and all that, and not everyone kind of just can cope with that. But it doesn't mean that somehow that you're not intelligent. It doesn't mean that you're not creative. It just means that sometimes, especially if sometimes if your life outside school is a bit chaotic, or if things aren't going well, or if there's disadvantage there and you're experiencing it, the way school works doesn't always suit you. And again, one of the great advantages of being a writer going in to work with kids is that I don't have to be part of the disciplinary regime. I don't have to get them to do X, Y and Z. I don't have to correct their homework. I just have to go and say, here's some thoughts I'm thinking, here's a bit of writing I'm doing, would you like to do, what do you think about that? Would you like to do some writing with me? It's very open, it's very invitational. And I also have the luxury of that if kids don't want to respond to that invitation, they walk away. A teacher, you don't have that luxury. So I know it's a kind of a privileged position. And I'm not saying that, you know, I get more from the kids than some teachers can. I'm just saying I'm in a situation that's very different, where kids can operate if they choose to in a way that's different from school. And some kids find really helpful and transformative.
You're listening to Write It Down, Write It All Down on Documentary on News Talk.
There was a lunar eclipse. I was out drinking with two of my oldest pals. One is called Glenn, one is Al. We were at Mastodon. They had just covered a song by a band you might know, Thin Lizzy. Before the end of the song, I got a text on my phone. It was about the moon. It said it's ending soon. So I grabbed my friend Al and said, let's check it out. This kind of shit doesn't happen too often. Oh, and like to giggle.
I thought Kevin was very welcoming. I'd say he's quite welcoming. And then we started to talk a lot more about like English and English literature. And like he, as I said, he encouraged me, and like we started to really like connect over our mutual interests in literature and writing itself. And so, although I was wary on the first day that I came in, I did eventually grow to appreciate the experience. I was very intrigued by it, because I wanted to see what the other people around me were capable of. Like there's a guy, he's a good friend of mine here. And he wrote some very good pieces. And this guy, I think he's very I'm not going to say shy, but he's not really as expressive as I would be. And to hear what this guy had to write, it was just mind-blowing to me, because it was really good. It was, and it's unbelievable to know that some of the shyest people have like a real message to portray to the community and to society itself. As I said previously, the workshop that went on allowed for free thinking and free thought and just expression of emotion. And I think that's what should be encouraged in students, more so than getting exam results. I think it should be focused on the well-being of students and getting them to where they want to be. Oh, and like, if you need to do more workshops, like the writing workshop, then so be it. But I think school should just be about the well-being and the further ambitions of the student. The book is known as Merdy's Shadow, and the certain concepts that I came up with, like he had us describe like the rooms or the houses and stuff like that, and I just threw in certain elements of my room, like for instance at home I have a wall just lined with baseball caps, like hip-hop kind of style baseball caps, and I just have a wall lined with these because I used to collect them, and that concept was actually used as an element of the story within the novel. So I was kind of proud of that, to be honest. And then he gave us all a copy of the book, and then just to see my name on the back of the book, that was kind of surreal.
Calvin told me, I asked him to describe his room for me. We did a whole thing about privacy and where you can get a sense of privacy in your world. Where'd you go for headspace? Where's the place that's yours and no one else's? And it was interesting, some of the kids didn't have that, just because of the nature of the number of people living in their family. But Calvin did have his own room, and he spoke about it very much and the way it was set up, and it was very vivid description, so very clear that I could really imagine it. But one of the things he told me was that he had a collection of baseball caps, and partly I'd say to do with hip-hop, and partly just because he likes them. But they're all from American baseball teams. And I had this vision of this row of caps in the room. So Marky in the novel, he has his room. And the way Calvin spoke about why he'd need a room of his own made a lot of sense to me. And it was bigger than, I think, any other room in the house in some ways, the biggest bedroom. And so I did the same thing in the novel. I gave Marky the biggest room in the house. And I wondered how Mary felt about that. Like, did she resent that her brother had the biggest room in the house? But the little details of what was in his room are taken from Calvin's description of his room. And so sometimes they would tell things about themselves that other kids in the class or in the little writing group would never have known. And so that going, God, I never knew that about you, you know. And then during one of those conversations in Ring's End, two of the kids told me that they spent a lot of the summer jumping off the Samuel Beckett Bridge into the Liffey. And to be honest with you, I thought that was a bit of bravado, a bit of spoofology, you know. And I said to them, I get out of that, you know. And so they took out their phones and they showed me. They had filmed each other. And then they started talking about the Japanese tourists coming to film them. And I had this image that somewhere in Tokyo, these Japanese tourists showing their friends videos of these two kids from Ring's End jumping in. And they had wetsuits. And it wasn't kind of messing, it was serious. And they dived and they jumped and they were beautiful and balletic and athletic. And then, of course, you kind of go from that to saying, but Jesus, what does the Liffey taste like? And I got lost in that, and they're answering. And again, that was one of those sessions that arose, or the sessions around the sea, that you start off with something and you're not sure how it's going to go. And then it just comes to life. And the kids are saying absolutely brilliant things. And some of those things are in the novel. And again, I was writing down little expressions that the young writers were saying as they were telling me, and reading it back to them. And when they get lost in that, when they got lost in, and they could imagine what they, and remember what they were doing, oh, the language is just beautiful.
Thank you so much, Ro. So now we're going to have a reading from the novel by Sarah Purcell and Abby Campbell, if you'd like to join us up here. So Sarah is the JCSP librarian in Margaret Alward, and Abby is a student in their year.
Thank you. But here's the thing. The Liffey is not half as dirty as you think it's going to be. No messing. You have to wear a wetsuit. You just do. But once you do that, it's grand. I kept my wetsuit down in Nanny's shed. Otherwise, I'd have to hang it out on the balcony. And my ma would have got a whiff off it. And there was some whiff. And I wore an old pair of runners. You had to have something on your feet. After each session, I'd change and have a shower with my nannies before heading up home. And my ma was none the wiser. She thought I was down in Allens. But I'll tell you one thing. Any time I did, I was buzzing. It was exhilarating. It was just the best thing ever. And there was always tourists taking photos of you. So you felt a little bit special. Alan came down with me a few times. I love Alan, but he's a total wuss when it comes to water. He's an okay swimmer in a swimming pool. But there's no way he'd swim in the sea or the lake. I laugh at him the way he goes on. Is it safe? He asks me 100 times. If you know what you're doing, I say to him, flirting. You're not going in again, are you? Do you not like watching me? It isn't that. So you do like watching me? You're amazing. Am I the best? Yeah, said Alan, smiling. So if I hold your hand, will you jump in with me? Ah, you're all right, Alan said, looking sick at the thought of it. Alan's afraid of the sea, so he is. Afraid of everything to do with it. He hates how cold the water is. He hates the taste of salt in his mouth. He freaks out if his feet touch a seaweed. And if he cannot see the bottom, forget it. He imagines there's jellyfish everywhere, or sharks. If it's a nice sunny day, he'll get into the water up to his waist. But that's it. Anything beyond that and he's in freak-out territory. And I mean freak-out. He says he has a phobia. Thalassophobia. Maybe he has. I don't know. I know he loves his big words. But in fairness, I did see him get really upset once. And it wasn't funny. We were on Hoathead looking at the view. All you could see was the sea. And nothing else. Stretching away as far as the horizon. And do you know what happened? Alan had a panic attack. I swear. He started hyperventilating and had a meltdown. Afterwards, he said that it was the vastness of the sea that freaked him out. He couldn't handle it. Me? I could look at the sea all day. I love everything about it. I love its fast and mysterious.
The novel opens with Mary's dad coming in with a really big idea. He's been down the pub and he's seen a programme on therapy dogs. And Mary's twin brother, Marky, is... both Mary and Marky were born prematurely. And he was the weaker of the twins. And he's always suffered ill health and he's prone to infections. And the dad sees this thing about therapy dogs and he comes on with this great idea from the pub that... would be fantastic to get Marky a therapy dog. So he bursts in the door and we kind of role played it, what he might say, some of the things that she might say, and we tried it out on different people. And then we all went off to write our version. And I wrote my version and Abby wrote her version. And in my version, when the dad bursts in the door, he goes, Jacinta, Jacinta. But when Abby came back with her version, she had Ginny, Ginny. Ginny, where are you? I have a great idea. And I said to her, where did you come up with Ginny? And Abby said, oh, well, you know, the dad, when he comes in, he has a few drinks. He's kind of affectionate. And he, so he calls his wife Ginny. But in a way, I felt that was a brilliant writer's insight. It's taking something that you know and that you see, the way maybe with a drink or two when people are a little bit more emotion loose and in their emotions and trying to cajole people. And it just made absolute sense to me that you might go, Ginny, Ginny. That's a writer's instinct. And Abby had loads of little things like that where she could just say something. And she'd say something that she'd imagine the ma saying or the da saying or Marky saying or Mary saying. And you knew that it was filtered through her own life experience. But it's a real writer's instinct that you take that observation and you can translate it like that into a piece of writing. And she had that in buckets. And I really admired her for that. And also I said to her, do you mind if I use that? So the opening of the novel, the very first thing that's spoken in the novel is Ginny, Ginny. And that's Abby Campbell, you know.
Like now I can, because I was, when we were given the little like idea of it, we had to go write it. I was thinking, this man's coming in locked. He's not going to be saying Jacinta, like. So I just shortened it down to Ginny and then that idea just stick with me. Like, I'd get into, like, the character. When we had to do, like, a bit of writing, I'd be thinking of him, like, drunk. Like, I'd be, like, thinking of him drunk. Like, thoughts are flying through his head and random stuff. So he's just popping out everything and then she's real stuck at home and serious. So, like, she's just, like, cop on. And he's just buzzing around the house like a big child after being out in the pub. I didn't really know I was good at it until, like, I started doing Writers Club properly, because I never really like wrote like for anyone to like see or correct it. I was just be for myself.
One of the interesting things about the residence that we tried to do was that we tried to have events that were in national cultural institutions. We had workshops, we call them master classes in Poetry Ireland, which has now in a beautiful building in Parnell Square. We had a showcase event in the National Library of Ireland. We had another showcase in the Mansion House. And part of the reason for doing that was to say to the young writers, it doesn't matter where you come from, you have as much right to have access to these cultural institutions by virtue of what you've written and what you've said and what you've composed as anyone else. You're part of this cultural community. And for me, that was ridiculously important. And I think that definitely came from the idea of Crumlin, of coming, growing up in Crumlin, and saying no one should be excluded from the cultural life of the country by virtue of where they come from. And I was really pleased, because some of the young writers were intimidated. But I was delighted, for example, Abby said, the first time I had to go up and read in public, I was sweating, you know. But once you did it once, it was okay.
It's empowering, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember one young writer, who was an absolutely fantastic young writer from Ring's End, said to me in the Mansion House when he was getting up to read under his breath, I'm going to kill you. Because he suddenly felt, this was, I don't know if I can do this. But he got up and he read, and I could see how proud he was of himself, that he'd overcome his nerves, and he got up and he had read it. And for me, that was probably one of the nicest moments in the whole residency. See that talented young man get up, who doubted himself, who doubted that he even had the right to be there, and to be read with such confidence. And for me, that was probably the most satisfying moment I had as the writer in residence, you know? Like, this world, is you belong in this world of creativity. This is your world. And you know, that goes back to Heaney and to Richard Ford and people like that, that you mightn't be, we mightn't be people of consequence in the public world, but we are people of consequence, and your life is of consequence, and the way you've written about it is of consequence, and deserves to be heard, and is good, you know. So walking along the back in Crumlin, yeah, that's an important motivation. Another great young writer I've had the pleasure of working with the last 2 years is Calvin Folan. And Calvin is going to read. I'm not quite sure. So, Calvin, I can't get you up here. So maybe if you'd like to come up to the front And we'll have to just project a little bit your voice. Calvin's a fantastic writer. As I said to her, he's ambitious, he's intellectual, he's philosophical, he's the greatest spoofer I've met in a long time. He's just one of nature's gentlemen. We have great fun when we meet, and we always have really interesting conversations, and some of the writing that has come out of the sessions have been fantastic. So, Mr. Calvin Folan.
Failing to portray our inner nature, vaudeville masks, we seclude our screaming souls. Hearts and minds chained to ill-conceived falsehoods, desires unseen, fruitful dreams crumble to sorrow. Fear of judgment by the hands that greet us, our greatest curse concealed.
Now, this is going to be a short little ceremony, but what we want to do is that we want to present a number of awards to some of our emerging writers.
It'll never do somehow.
For his intellectual daring and lyrical writing, this award is made to Calvin Folan.
You're the reason I'm driving on, but don't think twice, it's all right.
For her naturalistic dialogue and her understanding of character, this award is made to Abby Campbell.
There ain't no use in turning on your light, baby. The light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road.
So, many congratulations to our young writers for their reading, for those who received awards, for the librarians and teachers to help. Many thanks to Little Island for publishing our novel. Our work is done. I hope you enjoy the morning. And thank you for coming. Keep writing.
Oh, it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I am told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right.
Write It Down, Write It All Down was produced by Brian Kenny and Kevin McDermott and was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.